We are kinda at that point in the cycle where politics is running smack into the American economy. We're gonna talk about that, and also a little bit later, one new plan to make Baltimore better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 13th of May. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. This was a bifurcated kind of week economy-wise. Some consumer stuff, some corporate stuff. Yes, some political stuff, too, which does make it trifurcated. I get that. Anyway, lots to talk about. Here to do that are Cardiff Garcia from the blog FD Alphaville. Also, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. They're in our studio in New York. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kat.
So let's, Cardiff, let's start with you, and I want you to put yourself in this mindset. If you're an American consumer driving home this afternoon listening to this radio program, hearing what you have heard about the American economy this week, which is largely retailers are doing lousy, but consumers are still buying, what do you make of the American economy?
I'm actually feeling a little bit more hopeful. I think that so long as jobs growth continues, it means that people are going to have a little bit more money to spend. And it means that I think we can expect the U.S. economy to stay as resilient as it has for the last few years. Doesn't mean everything's great, but I think it has been resilient.
You really? Lee, do you agree with that use of the word resilient? Because I was going to jump in there, but I figure...
I think so. I mean, I would call it more of a slow and steady recovery, especially when the consumer is concerned. But what was interesting about this week is that you had this news that, you know, overall U.S., you know, consumers have spent more. But you looked at the results of some of the biggest retailers and they were terrible.
Yeah.
They were just terrible. And that's largely because a lot of that money is going to Amazon. So I think retailers have different issues, which are, you know, how to compete against Amazon and, you know, off-price retailers, et cetera, et cetera. But the good news is it's I think they'd rather deal with that than a consumer that is totally dead.
Right. And also, Cardiff, those the quarterly results numbers for those retailers were first quarter numbers, which we know is terrible, and maybe there's a bounce back going on here?
That's right. There might be some of a little bit of a bounce back going, but also remember that in the last few months, wages have also picked up a little bit. So that means that even if for some individual companies, things get a little bit harder because they're paying more money to their workers, it also means that workers have a little bit more money, and eventually that money will be spent in the U.S. And so I think that's largely a hopeful message.
All right. To the election then, Lee, a couple of things I want to talk about. First of all, Hillary Clinton this week said in a statement in response to some other news items, she supports an overhaul of the way the boards of the Federal Reserve banks, the regional feds, are staffed. That are the way people get on them, right? The people who are on them. She wants to get bankers off those regional Fed boards. Is that a big deal?
Well, I think it just shows that it's not that controversial, but I think it just shows how she is, how Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are pulling her to the left. These are things that they have both, this was based on a proposal that they and other senators had signed, and I think it's just more proof that she has been moving in that direction and calling for anything that, you know, inequality and making things more even. It also calls for having more minority representation at the Fed and some other things, too.
Cardiff, if you get the Donald Trump question, which goes like this. His tax his tax plan has been in the news this week. And without getting into the, you know, how much it's going to cost or whether he's going to cut or add or whatever he's going to do the deficit, what are we to make of the way he is handling his public comments on the economy of the United States?
Well, you know, it seems like his rhetorical strategy is to take all sides on every issue and to kind of preserve a certain amount of ambiguity so that he can act as like a kind of Rorschach blot for everyone. You know, if you want him to be the tax cutter, he's the tax cutter. If you want him to be the economy grower, he's the economy grower. I actually hope that a lot of people listening to this do go directly to the proposal and they do look at the specifics. And what they find there is that actually his tax plan would explode the deficit and the gains would largely go to people at the top. That's according to the best analysis we have so far. So, you know, cut through the rhetoric, go to the proposal and look at it.
Lee, one last thing for you. We have literally 18 seconds left. There's going to come a point where, yeah, I know, don't you hate it when I do that to you? Oh, 15 seconds. There's going to come a point soon when the economy we have at this moment is the economy that's going to be there on election day. How close are we to that point, do you think?
It's funny. Studies show that it's a lot further back than you think. I think we might have already passed it. I think it's it's at least 6 months.
Ooh.
But the electorate does get this fixed imprint of the economy. You saw it with George Bush the first, and it just stays there. So what you see is what you get.
Way
I guess.
To keep up, Kai. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FD Alphaville. Thanks, you two.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, a whole lot of not so good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The social and moral and political dimensions of the news from the Departments of Education and Justice today. Their instructions to states, school districts, and individual schools on the accommodation of transgender students are being, as you know, well covered elsewhere. We are going to stick to the actual letter of the law, Title IX of the United States Code, where the or else part of that letter is pretty well spelled out. If you take federal money, you got to do what we say. We gave Mitchell Hartman from our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting the job of figuring out exactly what's at stake here, funding-wise.
K through 12 public schools are mostly funded locally from property taxes and state budgets. But about one in every $10, $57 billion in all, comes from the feds, says Michael Griffith at the Education Commission of the States.
Federal dollars cover mainly Title I, or low-income kids, and IDEA, which is special education.
So, what's at stake if a state refuses to give transgender students access to the bathrooms of their choice?
If you look at North Carolina, they received about $1.5 billion. If you say even half of that is at risk, that's a pretty large amount of money.
And, says Griffith, it would hit poor kids hardest, though special ed programs might be exempt from punishment. Lawyer Elizabeth Marvin has been involved in numerous LGBT rights cases. She says this is a warning shot.
A message to agencies that receive federal funds that the Department of Justice is behind the Department of Education's interpretation, that they're willing to enforce it.
But she says not overnight or even this month or this year. There'd be investigations and legal procedures state by state and district by district before money was withheld. And what might it cost to comply? Peyton Chapman is principal at Lincoln High here in Portland. Her school simply turned three existing bathrooms into private gender-neutral ones.
There hasn't been a cost. I would say, professional development. It's time. It's teacher time. It's leadership time.
She says that's what it takes to get students, staff, and parents on board. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Let's say your company had a spare $1 billion. Let's say, in fact, your company had many spare $1 billion. You could do worse than invest it in the biggest consumer market on the planet. Apple is going to put $1 billion into China's big Uber competitor, Didi Chuxing, it's called. The only investment Apple's ever made that was bigger, by the way? Jimmy Iovine, Dr. Dre, and the headphone maker Beats. But I digress. Back to China. Apple wants to get a better foothold there, yes, but speculation is, I think you can fairly say rampant, that this deal is actually in pursuit of the company's rumored plan to build a self-driving car. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has that one.
Didi is an onomatopoeia. Deed, it basically translates to beep, beep. And in China, it's kind of like the Uber. It boasts 300 million users in 400 cities. Tim Cooling with tech analysis firm Canalys says Apple has good reason to want to link up with a company like that.
What this gives Apple is access to a large user base of people within China from which they can harvest data.
Data about driving habits and China's complicated road system. Professor Derek Cogburn at American University says almost every tech company is in the race for big data that informs product development and marketing. So if Apple is indeed making a self-driving car, getting into the rideshare market and further into China makes sense. Cogburn says he can picture that car.
You hailed an Apple self-driving car. You paid for it with your Apple Pay. You know, during the time that you're in the car, your music is playing.
And Jeremy Carlson with IHS Tech says for Apple to do anything big in China, riding shotgun with a Chinese company is a necessity.
To operate in China, especially in an industry like the automotive environment, you do need a joint venture. So you do need partnerships.
In a joint release with Apple, the CEO of Didi said the investment is an inspiration. In New York, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace desk of, it's hard to feel sorry for him, but still today.
Hedge funds, they are getting hit where it hurts, right in their money. Big insurance companies AIG and MetLife have said they are cutting their investments with hedge funds by between a half and two-thirds. We're talking a disinvestment of almost $7 billion from those two firms alone. Other big institutional investors are doing the same thing. Turns out that after a really good run, hedge funds as a whole just ain't what they used to be, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
Once upon a time, hedge funds were great.
In the 1990s, hedge fund investors made a lot of money.
Simon Lack is with SL Advisors and is author of The Hedge Fund Mirage.
And particularly between 2000 and 2002, when we had the dot-com bubble unraveling and a big fall in equities, hedge funds did a great job. They hedged, they preserved capital, they added value.
And hedge funds, being so great, could charge a lot of money. 2% of what you invest and 20% of what you win. And even with these fees, investors flocked to join in. And then one day, people realized hedge funds weren't great.
Their performance as a whole has lagged the S&P for 6 or 7 years.
Roger Lowenstein is author of America's Bank. What happened? Well, everyone wanted to invest with hedge funds, and then everyone wanted to start a hedge fund.
There are now 10,000 hedge funds, way more than logic, common sense, or experience now going over many years suggests are that talented.
So there's not 10,000 Stephen Hawking-level geniuses out there all beating the market. On top of that, hedge funds now manage $3 trillion. It's a bit hard for all that money and all those funds to find the few slam dunk deals in the market. And markets are a lot more efficient than they were in the 90s.
You've seen some of the weaker hands fold up shop and leave the industry.
Ray Nolte is co-managing partner of Skybridge Capital. They invest in a lot of hedge funds. He says hedge funds are being pruned, and so should expectations. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up,
many people come to museums and just immediately start taking photographs rather than slowing down and taking a look at the work.
Art museums in this digital age. But first, let's do the numbers. I was totally expecting the wah-wah trombones. I don't know what's up with that. The Dow off 185 points, 1%, 17,535. I don't get everything I want. The NASDAQ fell 19 points, 0.4%, 4717. The S&P 500 gave back 17 points, 0.8%, 2046. For the week gone by, the Dow shed 1.2%, the NASDAQ off 0.4%, the S&P 500 down about 0.5%. We told you earlier about Apple and Didi Chuxing. Apple rose 0.1% today. Microsoft sliced off 0.8%. How about a burger this weekend, huh? Shake Shack beat estimates. Its stock slurped up nearly 10%. Sticking with food, McDonald's refunded 1% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.70%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The trial of a second Baltimore police officer involved in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray a little bit more than a year ago started this week. The riots that followed, as you know, damaged hundreds of businesses and forced that city to face its history of racial and economic inequality. Some of Baltimore's biggest companies have joined together in that effort, led by the city's largest private employer, Johns Hopkins University and Health System. From our education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
It's 11 p.m., and William Glover Bay is gathering supplies for the overnight shift at Johns Hopkins Hospital.
Al, did you get a radio?
Not yet.
Okay, let me get a radio.
Glover Bay is 59 and has been in this job a year, cleaning floors in the emergency department. He's actually trained as a drug addiction counselor, but he'd been out of work for 2 years before landing here.
When I got here, it was amazing how many people seem to be angry. I'm excited about working. I don't know about nobody else. And they're like, how are you still happy this time of night? I'm grateful. That's why I'm happy.
He's grateful because he spent more than 15 years in prison when he was younger, mostly for selling drugs. He's one of 174 people hired by the hospital last year as part of a program to bring in ex-offenders.
Because I've been to jail and I've worked and done long jail holes for $6 a month, you think I can't do this here for whatever they pay us a day? Oh, nah, this is easy.
So, Hopkins wants to create opportunities for more people like Glover Bay through a broader initiative called Hopkins Local. The goal is to award more construction and purchasing contracts to local women and minority-owned businesses and have 40% of new hires for certain entry-level jobs come from neighborhoods with high unemployment and poverty.
The 40% target has focused on those neighborhoods by zip code that we regard as most distressed.
That's Ron Daniels, president of the university. Under a new screening process, applicants from those zip codes get a guaranteed look, and if they're qualified, they'll be passed on to hiring managers.
They can be everything from entry-level technicians to people working in custodial services and catering just throughout the organization.
Daniel says the program was in the works long before Freddie Gray, a young black man, died in police custody a year ago. But he says the protests and violence that followed exposed the deep racial and economic divide in the city and made the need more urgent. Last month, two dozen more employers, including Under Armour, T. Rowe Price, and the local power company, joined the effort, now known as Be Local. Daniels is co-chairman of the $69 million initiative.
It's not a comprehensive solution. It's not going to touch the vast majority of the unemployed in Baltimore, but it represents an important statement of how we think about making our city stronger.
Johns Hopkins has a complicated legacy in the city.
Baltimore has always had a kind of love-hate relationship with Johns Hopkins, especially in the neighborhoods immediately surrounding the hospital.
Richard Clinch directs the University of Baltimore's Jacob France Institute, which studies workforce and economic development in the region. In recent years, the hospital has been criticized for a massive urban revitalization project that displaced many African-American residents without delivering as many jobs as promised. And Clinch says it won't be easy to fill the new jobs with the people who most need them. Many have criminal records or didn't finish high school.
The residents of Baltimore face many workforce challenges, and not many of them are ready for the types of jobs that are being created.
Hopkins put me in touch with some of the people it has hired since the program started in January. Brittany Fergal is an administrative coordinator at the School of Public Health. In her zip code, almost half the adults aren't working, and the poverty rate is 37%. But Fergal lives in a more affluent pocket, a stone's throw from the Inner Harbor tourist district. Does your neighborhood feel distressed to you?
No, and I just moved here in September, so I'm new to Baltimore completely.
Fergal is not representative of the disadvantaged communities Hopkins says it's trying to help. She's white and has a college degree and moved here from Albany, New York after the riots.
Being here really shows that they're trying to rebuild, and even though I wasn't affected by it, and I wasn't here at the time, it still helps the community as a whole.
Are you all caught up?
Ashley Colin grew up in Baltimore in a middle-class Puerto Rican-Italian family. She already had a similar job when she was hired to help check in cancer patients at Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. But the new job was much closer to her neighborhood.
Right now, I wouldn't consider it as distressed, but it used to be. It got more safer and quiet, and maybe since they knocked down some of those houses and rebuild new ones, that it kind of made it a little bit better.
A Hopkins spokesman says the program is still being developed, and of the dozens of people who've been hired so far, the majority are underrepresented minorities. Hopkins is also working with neighborhood groups and job readiness programs to recruit people who have struggled to find work. Groups like Turnaround Tuesday in East Baltimore.
Because once you make it, we got to look behind, and when you all are working, we got to have this room filled with another group just like you so we can do it again.
Every Tuesday, dozens of people get together in this church basement to learn skills like interviewing and communication and hear a little preaching from Pastor Marshall Prentice. Executive Director Melvin Wilson says he's confident the Hopkins effort is sincere.
I believe that this Be Local hiring is a commitment that truly will change our community for a long time.
It was Turnaround Tuesday that helped William Glover Bay find his job at Johns Hopkins. He says he's making just under $12 an hour, which helps support his five children.
Can it be better? Yes. But if you are ambitious enough, you know, you look for advancements. And that's what I do.
With his background as a drug counselor, he's planning to apply for one of hundreds of new jobs in the city, doing health outreach in distressed neighborhoods. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Just about 3 years ago, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art closed for renovations, a $305 million makeover. It reopens tomorrow. Just because the museum was closed, though, doesn't mean the city stood still. In the 3 years that SF MoMA was closed, San Francisco has, as we all know, changed a whole lot, becoming even more profoundly tech-centric and, let's just face facts here, more distracted by technology than ever. So the dilemma that faces the new museum is, how do you present art in a digital city? Our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood went to find out.
San Francisco's Modern Art Museum is centrally located right at the intersection of the city's multiple identities. It's in the heart of the tech hub, it's a few blocks from the financial district, and it steps away from tourist-clogged Market Street.
In many ways, being welcoming is the first step.
That's Craig Dykers, co-founder of Snohetta, the architecture firm that designed SF MoMA. To take that step, the museum includes 40,000 square feet of free public space, separate from the galleries, where admission is $25. If you're under 18, it's free. In the public lobby, there are amphitheater-style stairs, so you can sit and admire a massive set of rusted steel coils sculpted by Richard Serra. Or you can chat, or you can work. There's free Wi-Fi, of course. Finding a place to put the new building in this crowded city wasn't easy.
We found space to the rear of the building, which had been a kind of alleyway and a loading dock. And we consolidated all that space and, in a way, pulled a rabbit out of the hat.
The new structure is 10 stories tall, but very narrow. The facade is made of hundreds of different white cement and polymer panels stacked on top of each other. It looks like a deck of cards that's been quickly shuffled but not squared off. The outside may be complicated, but inside, Dyker says the design is all about reducing distraction in a city that kind of thrives on it.
Many people come to museums and just immediately start taking photographs of the art with their phone or start Instagramming their experience rather than slowing down and taking a look at the work.
The galleries are airy and clean. The hallways are huge and open. And there are wall-sized windows and terraces so that the SF skyline is part of the experience. And of course, this is still San Francisco, so there's geeky stuff too.
There's a sense of the city as a research and development environment. There's this appetite to create new experiences.
Keir Winesmith heads up digital projects at the museum. Part of what's new is that interactive tech features are mixed right in alongside the art, kind of like in real life. And for the tours, the museum partnered with what else? A local startup.
We decided to do away with the traditional audio tour that has kind of remained unchanged for 50 or 60 years.
Instead, you can download an app that tracks your location using the Wi-Fi signals coming from your phone. It stops when you stop and starts when you start walking again. It can even sync a group tour. And you have a choice of storytellers, comedians from the HBO show Silicon Valley or players from the San Francisco Giants. And here's a sample from Philippe Petit, the French high wire artist who walked between the World Trade Center towers.
I have learned a lot preparing this walk through the museum. So when I share something with you, it's not because I am now an expert. It's because I slowed down enough to open my mind and learn.
Learn about installations like New Work by Portuguese artist Leonor Antunes. It's a sculpture that fills a gallery with hanging geometric partitions, leather sculptures, and woven ropes. It's pretty modern. Rosanna Romaro is an art student from Houston, and she loved it.
There's a lot of today art compared to, like, most museums. You know, they usually have, like, a 10-year gap. There's a lot of, like, 2016.
Personally, I fell in love with Untitled Blue Monochrome by Eve Klein. It's a simple, brilliant blue canvas painted in 1955 by an innovator who would have fit right in Silicon Valley. Klein patented that brilliant blue, and he was manipulating photographs Photoshop style decades before Photoshop existed. Do I need to remind you that this is the new Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco? And that's where I am. I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
Art being, in this case, a visual medium, there's a slideshow of the new building on our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, one more item from the economy politics nexus we seem to have found today. The pharmaceutical giant Pfizer announced this afternoon that it's not going to let any of its products be used in lethal injections. That means states in this country where executions are legal now no longer have open market above board sources they can buy execution drugs from. Pfizer is just the most recent of 20 or so European and American drug companies to make their products off limits for executions. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks so much for listening to Marketplace. You hear me do the numbers every day, but we aim to bring you more than the numbers. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. We'd like you to help keep our numbers strong by making a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace. And this month, your gift in any amount is going to be automatically doubled thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. So please donate today at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 185 points today, 1% minus the Wawa trombones, it shall be noted. The NASDAQ off 19 points, 0.4%. I'm not naming any names. The S&P 500 gave back 17 points, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. He'd have given me the wah-wahs. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. I'm just saying, right? Come on.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.